So Charlie phoned up a couple of months ago and I said, would I be able to speak at a SummerLink? And I said, well, maybe. What's the theme? And he said, favourite verses about God. To which I said, well, thanks, that narrows it down a bit. And my first thought, what I said to him in that conversation was, Psalm 73, verses 25 and 26. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. But if you were at the 4 o'clock or the 6 o'clock services, Sunday just gone, you'll know that it's a very good thing that slightly later that day I thought, now that psalm tends to get preached on relatively frequently. Let's do Habakkuk instead. And so Habakkuk 3, verses 17 to 19, slightly less familiar, perhaps, than the others. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. Now, I'm at risk of making myself look a bit of a fool in front of you right here at the beginning, but I'll tell you about a significant point in my life a couple of years ago. It was a difficult time, and at this difficult time, I thought I'd go out for a run to make myself feel better, and I went for a run along a particular path that had particular significance, and as I ran, this massive thunderstorm started, and the rain was pouring down, and the thunder was breaking. And I ran to a particular point, again, which had significance. And I stood on that point, and I shouted these verses. It could have been Dawson's Creek, if there'd been a cheesy song playing in the background, or if you're a bit younger, The O.C. Probably, I never actually watched that. And if you're from an older generation, then I'm sorry, I can't help you. But chat to one another afterwards and work out what it would be. Well, why these verses? Well, I've got two illustrations that I'm going to come back to a number of times. And the first is based on the Etch-a-Sketch. Do you remember Etch-a-Sketch? Kind of small red plastic sort of grey screen with a couple of wheels. And you drew on the screen with these wheels. And it worked with sort of, I think it's graphite powder and magnetism. I found that out on Wikipedia at the time. We thought that it was magic. And so imagine yourself back, five-year-old Andrew Holt, there in the reception class at River Primary School, beautiful ginger curls. I know that's hard to believe, but it is true. And I've been sitting there, I've spent ages twiddling the dials, drawing a beautiful picture. And my little heart is kind of bursting with pride at this great picture I've drawn, and then my worst enemy comes along. You always had worst enemies at primary school, didn't you? Sort of best friends and worst enemies were made very quickly. And he wants the Etch-a-Sketch. And so he tries to grab it from me. I try to grab it back. And he tries to grab it again. But I get it from him, but it's too late. Because with the Etch-a-Sketch, when you shook it, the picture was gone. Well, that doesn't matter, because that was probably a sort of couple of stick men and a house with smoke coming out of the chimney. But when our plans, our life plans, our future is wiped away in a moment, just like that picture is wiped away in a moment. We've intricately planned our life. We've laid it out. We've constructed it. We've visualized what it's going to be like. And God says, actually, no, that's not my plan for you. And just like Etch-a-Sketch, shake it up, and it's blank. It's gone. You can't see the future anymore. You don't know what it's going to hold. That's the first illustration. And the second one is sort of a picture that I sometimes think about. And I'm there, I'm on a raft. And I'm on the raft in the middle of a big, kind of slow-flowing river. It's sort of banks on the sides. It's fairly nice. But I don't know where the river goes. And I have nothing to control the raft with. And the stream, sort of where we're going, is kind of hazy. There's probably a waterfall. There's always a waterfall with these sorts of things. And the thing is, this river is kind of my life, and I don't know where it's going. And I'm scared of where it's going to take me if I just let it drift. I'm scared of the unknown. But what I do have is I have anchors, and so I put down anchors to hold me in place so that I'm more stable. A secure job, family, friends, my living situation, my future plans is one of them. and they become who I am. They become my safety, my identity. I feel more secure with these anchors down. I'm a son. I'm a brother. Perhaps, you know, if it's job, I might be a lawyer or a financial PR executive or an accountant. Do you really want that to be your identity? Joke. I love all you accountants, really. But if you put down enough, you feel stable. You feel stable, but you're not. Whether it's that the ropes are weak or that the riverbed is soft, one by one, they come loose. Perhaps unexpected redundancy. That's an anchor gone. A relationship ends. That's an anchor gone. Someone you love deeply dies. And it's an anchor gone. And you're unstable again, moving about on the face of the waters. And in the worst case, you lose all of them. And you're cut loose to drift. And you don't know where you're going. And you're afraid because you don't know who you are anymore. And you don't know what the future will hold. Now, that may be where some people in this room are tonight. And as we look around, it doesn't look that way, does it? We're a sort of a relatively young crowd. On a global scale, most of us in this room are exceptionally wealthy and privileged. Those who've been here a while, as you turned up this evening, you probably greeted a few mates with some banter and a smile. And if you're new, I hope you've been similarly warmly greeted. The kind of struggle I'm talking about doesn't always show on the outside. I remember two conversations with a good friend of mine, a guy that some of you will know, popular, outgoing, always at the centre of the party. And twice in the last few years, relationships ended for him painfully. Now, I don't know if he would remember this, but he used almost identical words both times that I spoke to him. In the midst of a party, one at Christmas and one in the summer a little further ago, happy kind of conversation, jokes going on all around us, music playing, he just pulled me aside and he said, "Mate, I know I look like I'm doing fine, but inside, I'm broken. There's nothing. I'm kind of saying, look, Jesus, if you want to take me now, if this is the end today, that's fine with me." And maybe for you tonight, that might be where you are. The anchors have torn loose, the future is a blank, and you're afraid. It's been me sitting here in this room in St. Helens, and no one knew. And so the question is, when everything is stripped away, when your life, your future plans are taken and etch-a-sketch wiped, where do you go? When every anchor comes loose, where is your security? Where is your identity? Well, why these verses? Why Habakkuk 3, 17 to 19? Well, firstly, because Habakkuk knows pain. Habakkuk knows what he is talking about. As Habakkuk writes, life is bad, and not only is there no prospect of it getting better, he has a promise it's going to get worse. So firstly, when life falls apart and all hope seems lost. And at this point, I will need a Bible. So Habakkuk chapter 3:17. Thanks, Saji. So the year, as Habakkuk writes, it's somewhere around 610 to 600 BC. Israel has already been split in two. Assyria is the dominant power, with Judah, the southern kingdom where Habakkuk lives, a vassal state forced to pay tribute to its overlord, Assyria. But Babylon, in the distance, is advancing across the nations. And in Judah itself, Judah is chaos. Habakkuk is quite a short book, just three chapters. You might want to flick through as I go. So the first two chapters are two cycles. Question from Habakkuk, answer from God. Question from Habakkuk, answer from God. Here is my paraphrase of Habakkuk's questions and God's answers. Chapter 1, verses 2 to 4, Habakkuk says, "How long, O Lord, until you do something about the unrighteousness and injustice I see before me here in Judah? How long will you make me look at iniquity? And why do you idly look at wrong?" Chapter 1, verses 4 to 11, we get God's answer. God says, "I will do something you would not believe. I will bring judgment, but I will bring it by bringing the Babylonians, who will crush everything in their path, including you. And Habakkuk is devastated by this. Chapter 1, verses 12 to 2, verse 1, he replies, "How can you judge us with these people who are worse than we are? Their sin is worse than our own. Will they not be judged?" Chapter 2, from verse 2, God replies, "They will be judged, and comprehensively judged, but on my timeline. And when justice falls, the righteous shall live by his faith." And then we get to chapter 3, and chapter 3 is Habakkuk's response to this. It is a prayer, it is a psalm of response by Habakkuk. But so those are the predictions in chapter 1 and 2. And what does happen in history? Well, in 612 BC, the Babylonians destroy the Assyrian city of Nineveh. In 605 BC, the Assyrians are finally defeated at the Battle of Carchemish. In 605 BC, the Babylonians take control of Judah, and the king Jehoiakim has to swear allegiance to the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, probably a familiar name to many. 597 BC, after Jehoiakim rebels, Nebuchadnezzar crushes that rebellion and puts Zedekiah in Jehoiakim's place. And then foolishly, in 586 BC, Zedekiah rebels again against Nebuchadnezzar. And this time Nebuchadnezzar has no mercy. Jerusalem is stormed, the temple is destroyed, the Judean dynasty is terminated, and large sections of the population are deported to other parts of the Babylonian Empire. Well, why did I bother to give that kind of brief history lesson? Why does that matter? Well, it matters because if this is La La Land, or if this is theory, then I will say to Habakkuk, don't talk to me. I want to talk to someone who has seen pain for themselves. I don't want an ivory tower prophet. I want someone who has asked the hard questions, that has experienced the depths before writing about the heights. And this isn't La La Land. This is our world. This is real history. Real armies storming across a real globe. Real blood on real sand. Real pangs of hunger as the crops and livestock are devoured by the invading force. Real despair as a lifetime's wealth is lost in a day. And real tears prompting real questions. So chapter 1, verse 13, Habakkuk's response to the judgment predicted. "You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and are silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he?" Why do you make me sit and look at evil, Habakkuk says to God. Why do you idly sit in heaven and appear to do nothing? How can you judge a more righteous nation with a less righteous one? And why do you allow them to devastate our land to the extent that the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls? Because that is where Habakkuk fully expects things to end up. And he's right too. Now this devastation of the crops and livestock of Israel is far more significant than just going to Tesco and finding that they haven't been restocked. It's not just about food. But to really get it, we need a bit of Old Testament background knowledge. Now I'm going to ask you guys to do that, but I'll say how I think is a good way of doing it. Hey, you're in charge of your tables. You can do it how you like, but this is my recommendation. So there are a few verses from the Old Testament on that sheet. And what I reckon is if you read those around the table, so nominate people to read each one, you don't all need to look them up because that'll mean it'll take much longer. But one person to read each of those and just listen. What are the impressions you get as you read? To the nation of Israel, what do fig tree, vine, flock, and herd signify? What does their presence indicate? What does their absence imply? And I've got one more reference that I want to add. I was going to put this in later, but we'll bring it now instead. And that is 1 Kings chapter 4, verses 20 to 25. 1 Kings chapter 4, verses 20 to 25. So maybe nominate someone on your table to sort of lead things. If you haven't introduced yourselves around the tables yet, please do so. Welcome any newcomers. And I'll be back in about 10 minutes. Okay, I make that 10 minutes. Hope you guys managed to get through a good chunk of those, if not all. Now, this is high risk. So if you're really, really not sure, don't shout out. But this is kind of feedback time. What do flock and vine, field and herd and fig represent in kind of the bigger picture of things? Any thoughts? Oh, Andrew Satch, what do you think?
Blessings from God.
My God, because they have been in a period of obedience and in a period of pleasing to God, and He's rewarded them with good things, with crops and with livestock, and also fulfillment because they have to pay these things. And it's usually
I might pause it there because I want to repeat it back so that everyone can hear it, but I'm not sure if I can remember all of it. A land of obedience and provision based on their a land of abundance and provision based on their obedience. And Satch, you said
blessing that God gives them.
Blessing that God gives them. Yeah, is that roughly what most people kind of came up with? Half-hearted nods, excellent, can't expect better than that. So the presence then of these things, the presence yet is a blessing from God. And the absence of these things is a judgment from God, a removal of what they could have had and a loss of what they should have been. So the presence of these things are code for blessing, for everything as it should be under God. And their loss is code for curse. And with their loss comes the loss of everything else. So what is coming is the attack that you read about in Jeremiah chapter 5, verse 17. I'll read it again. They shall eat up your harvest and your food. They shall eat up your sons and your daughters. They shall eat up your flocks and your herds. They shall eat up your vines and your fig trees. Your fortified cities in which you trust, they shall beat down with the sword. And as we saw, that happened 605 BC, 597 BC, finally 586 BC. And what would have stung so much is that these things into which they put their trust, their hope, which they then lost, weren't bad things. They were good things. They were blessings to God, from God. They were things promised to Israel by God. And so therefore the loss of them was a loss of their identity, who they were as a nation, as a people. They would have thought of themselves, we are the people whose God gives us a good land, a people whose God gives us a safe land, a fruitful land, safe borders, our own king, the security of Jerusalem itself, where God dwells in his holy temple. Surely God would not allow these blessings to be stripped away from his people. And into that misplaced self-confidence, God speaks, chapter 1, verse 5. Look among the nations and see, be astounded, for I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. And so when they lose all these things, it's not just economic devastation, it's identity devastation, every anchor cut. Everything they trusted in, everything that made them who they thought they were, taken away. The land no longer their own. Safety within their borders, a dream. Crops and livestock, a memory. A puppet king. Jerusalem in ruins and the temple destroyed. Cut adrift. And for us, in the same way, often the anchors that we put down, they're good things, not bad things. And often they are things promised to us by God. And often they are things in which, to an extent, we do find our identity, who we are as individuals, as communities. I am a person who has a job, a role. I am a friend. I am a son. I am a brother, an uncle, a nephew. For some, a husband or wife, a parent, a boyfriend or girlfriend. We were made for relationship. Those things aren't wrong, but we make them absolute. We refuse to accept that they could ever be taken away. Just as the Israelites said, surely not Jerusalem, surely not the temple. We say, surely not this relationship, surely not this job. Surely God would not allow these things to be taken away from us. And that is why the pain of losing these things can be so devastating. Why even losing your job, while not a kind of a bereavement, not a grief situation, is profoundly disorientating and unnerving. We're cut adrift and we can't see our future. Now, at this point, we do need to differentiate between the Israelites and between us. So as we've seen, for the Israelites, this is, no two ways about it, a judgment from God. It is the ultimate fulfillment of the curses of the Mosaic covenant. Just as the good things they had received were blessings of obedience, so what is coming upon them are curses for disobedience. So back in Deuteronomy 28, God predicted this. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord your God to keep his commandments and his statutes that he commanded you, the Lord will bring a nation against you from far away, a hard-faced nation who shall not respect the old or show mercy to the young. It shall eat the offspring of your cattle and the fruit of your ground until you are destroyed. It also shall not leave you grain, wine or oil, the increase of your herds or the young of your flock, until they have caused you to perish. So for them, this shouldn't have been a surprise. This is the result of their unrighteousness. Now, when we lose things in this life, when things are taken away from us, it is not specific punishment for specific sins. It is not specific punishment for specific sins, but it is traceable back to sin. So God made this world good, all good. But when we turned against our Creator, suffering and pain entered into the world in a way they hadn't before. And it created a rupture in the relationship between us and God, but also between human and human, and with the creation itself. So just like the cracks spreading out in a pane of glass when you throw a stone at your brother across the garden, and he ducks and it hits the shed window instead. So the consequences of sin spread far and wide, as the very creation itself is cursed because of our sin, still with echoes of all that made it good. Satisfaction in work, joy in family and relationships, the beauty of nature, but all of these things broken and damaged. And so we live in a fallen world, a cursed creation. And just as both the more and the less righteous within Judah would have suffered when the Babylonians invaded, so today suffering affects all of us. Christian, not Christian, we all suffer within this world. Now this may raise bigger questions than we have time to look at now. Is God in control of these sorts of things? So for example, one of the most popular books on suffering is this, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, Rabbi Harold Kushner, a liberal Jewish rabbi. I would not recommend this book. His answer to the problem of suffering is, can you forgive God for not being powerful enough to stop suffering in the world? God wants to stop suffering, but he can't. We can't let ourselves have that answer, because that is not the God of the Bible. And there is no comfort in a sad, hand-wringing God who sits in heaven wanting to stop suffering, but can't. Our God is the God of Habakkuk, the God who is able to bring a nation from one side of the earth to the other, and then break that nation just as quickly. But if this does raise questions that we don't have time to answer now, these are three books I would recommend. So the first introduction, I would say, would be the chapter on suffering from Tim Keller's The Reason for God. Tim Keller, The Reason for God, fantastic chapter on suffering in that great first introduction. Slightly longer, subtly different title, don't buy the other one by mistake, buy this, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? Melvin Tinker, but you can see what he did there. And then thirdly, this is kind of the beast. The cover is slightly better now than it was when I bought my copy. How Long, O Lord, by Don Carson. And that is It's brilliant. Cannot recommend it highly enough. So, Habakkuk. What is lost to Habakkuk and his people is taken away by God. And there you go. Pause. Now, some of you here, you are saying, this is all a little bit depressing. Sometimes God brings good things out of bad things, surely, Holty. Sometimes things get better. Cheer up, man. Well, you're right. Sometimes things do get better. Sometimes God does bring good out of bad. So I came up with that kind of lost anchors illustration at a time when my future plans were completely wiped. The situation that I'd been in, where I lived, changed completely, became much more challenging. And I'd walked away from a potential relationship knowing that I was doing the right thing, but knowing it would torment me to do so, and it did. Anchor gone, anchor gone, anchor gone, and I felt adrift. But now I can look back on those things and say, they were right, absolutely, and they were good. And sometimes we get that. Sometimes things get better again. And sometimes we get to see why painful experiences happen to us, and that is a gift. But sometimes we don't. And sometimes we will never know. So when I was 11, my grandparents were involved in an accident caused by a dangerous driver. He walked away from the accident, and he walked away from court afterwards. But my grandparents didn't. Neither of them died quickly. My grandfather died at the scene. My grandmother died in ICU a week later. And I will never know in this life why it was better to lose them almost 20 years ago than to have had those decades with them since. I will never know what it was better for my father to lose his parents 20 years ago than to share time with them in a couple of decades since. And sometimes we lose someone that we love in breakup or possibly in divorce or in death, and they're gone forever and they are never coming back, and we'll never stop missing them. Or some here might long to be married, and you will never be married. And for some people here, your career ambitions may crumble before your eyes, and you will never see them fulfilled. And that is what this passage is here for. This passage is for those situations where you're at the bottom of the valley and you cannot see the light at the top. In fact, you do not even know which way is up. Because for Habakkuk, that is his situation. In his lifetime, it will never get better. He may or may not have lived to see things hit rock bottom with the destruction of Jerusalem, but he couldn't possibly have lived to see the return from exile nor the rebuilding of the temple. And he knew that he wouldn't. And so when in the face of that he says, "Yet I will rejoice in the Lord, I will take joy in the God of my salvation," I want to say how, and I want to say why. So our second point, I will rejoice because with God all hope is never lost. I will rejoice in the Lord, Habakkuk says. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. And so our question is, what is this salvation? Well, back in Habakkuk's second question, he said, how can you judge a more righteous nation with a less righteous one? And God said, don't worry, Habakkuk, they will get their comeuppance. It may not come as quickly as you like, but it will come, and it will be terrible. And through all of this, through all the turbulence, your nation is going to see the righteous shall live by faith. The righteous shall live by faith. Well, what does that mean? Are we to believe that only unrighteous people were killed when the Babylonians invaded? Or that only unrighteous people are exiled? Or that many years later in the return from exile, it's only the righteous people that are privileged ones to come back? Or that only the unrighteous ones had their crops and livestock plundered? Well, it can't be that. So does it mean that the righteous will have a kind of a strength to endure through these hard times? Well, there's something to that. But as we've already said, what is the point if the difficult times never end? There's no getting through it for Habakkuk and his people, because in this life there's nothing after it. Life is pain, and then you die. It's not a particularly comforting thought that 100 years in the future, flock and crops and vine and fig tree might come back. So this life which the righteous inherit must be something more. This salvation in which Habakkuk rejoices has to be something beyond this life. What then does it mean to live by faith? Well, Habakkuk couldn't have known fully, but we can. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4, the righteous shall live by faith. It's picked up three times in the New Testament. We're going to look at Romans chapter 1, verse 17. I'll read it, look it up if you like, but you don't need to if you don't want to. Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. Paul writes this: I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith, for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. But here's the problem. Paul then spends the next three chapters convincing us that there isn't anyone who's righteous. He concludes in chapter 3, verses 10 to 12, no one is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. So the righteous shall live by faith, but there is no one who is righteous. And we know that it was true in Habakkuk's day. So for hundreds of years, Israel has been worshipping other gods, turning from righteousness, looking to idols to get the things that God has promised to them, loving the gifts that God gave them more than they love him. They may have been more righteous than the Babylonians, but they weren't righteous by God's standards. And these curses were the punishment for their unrighteousness. And have we changed all that much since those days? Perhaps we're more subtle than their kind of more obvious sins. But we seek our joy and our satisfaction not in the God who made us, but in the things that he gives us, in our work, in our relationships, in our material comforts, depending on them to fulfill longings they can never satisfy. And is that not in part why we react so angrily when we lose them? Why it's so painful when those anchors are torn loose? Because in fact, instead of God, we've made them the ground of our rejoicing. We've made those things our treasure. We are just as unrighteous as they were. And yet, God has made a way for us to be righteous by faith. Because in the history of Israel, there was one man who was righteous. There was one man who deserved a life of blessing, one man who did not deserve death. But instead, that man suffered more than any of us ever will. He was born into poverty. He lived his early years as a refugee. When he returned to his own country, he was variously rejected by the people of his town, by the religious and political authorities, and even by his own family. Even though no one could find any guilt in him, he was betrayed by a close friend, hauled before a kangaroo court. And though all his followers said that they would stand with him until the end, when it came to the crunch, they abandoned him and left him to face his punishment alone. Every anchor cut away. And then he was mocked. And then he was spat on. And then he was stripped naked and beaten. Real tears. Real hunger, real thirst, real blood on real sand. And he died in agony, fixed to a wooden cross with nails through his hands and his feet. And this righteous man, whose name was Jesus, died the death of an unrighteous man so that we might benefit from his righteousness by faith. And whilst I may be caught up in the violence and despair of this world, I can be saved by faith in Christ. Habakkuk didn't know how a righteous God would save an unrighteous people, but he rejoiced in God because he knew that ultimately he would save him. He would save those who would trust him by faith. And he rejoiced because he knew how good that salvation would be. Did many tables get to 1 Kings chapter 4, verses 20 to 25? Put a hand up if you did. Not many. In which case, flick to that now. First person there, shout out the page number. Page 339. These are amazing verses. So this is a glimpse of the pinnacle of the kingdom of Israel. Just a little picture of how good things could be. I'll read them for us. Page 339, 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 20. Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen and 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. For he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates from Tifsah to Gaza, over all the kings west of the Euphrates. And he had peace on all sides around him. And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree all the days of Solomon. So far from being ruled over by a foreign nation, Solomon ruled all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and the border of Egypt. Far from the field yielding nothing and flock and herd being absent, Solomon's personal provision was 30 cores of flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 oxen, 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. Now, presumably that was for his whole household, unless he was a very big lad. So this, in many ways, is the opposite of Habakkuk. This is a little glimpse of the life that Habakkuk looked forward to one day, and the life that we, too, can inherit. A reversal of all that is lost and broken here. And I love that little phrase, every man under his vine and under his fig tree. This inheritance that we're promised, this salvation, is not a floaty, ethereal Philadelphia advert heaven. It is real. It is physical. I don't know what you imagine when you think of heaven. For me, I think of the words of the great theologian, Jay-Z, and his treatise, Forever Young. He says, with the champagne always cold and the music always good. Or Dr. Dre, get my boys off of jobs, barbecues every day, driving fancy cars. Now, maybe you're not as gangster as I am. So perhaps that doesn't resonate with you. But think about what does. Again, maybe that image of the vine and the fig tree. I'm not impartial to a bit of gardening myself. I remember one morning I'd picked the stones out of the lawn, mowed it with the fly mow, sat back and looked at it and thought, that was a good morning. And then I thought, I'd become my dad. But it was a good morning. And Habakkuk says, for now I wait patiently, even though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, even though everything in this world in which I might have put my security, I might have built my identity, has been stripped away, yet I will rejoice in the solid, unchanging rock that is the Lord. He is my salvation, and in him I'm not on a raft. I am on a rock, and nothing can take my joy from me. And so, lastly and much more briefly, and so I can get up in the morning. Habakkuk 3, verse 19. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. By which Habakkuk means, because my joy is in the God who will save me, I can keep going. He gives me the strength to be bold. He gives me the courage to tread the high mountainous paths in full view, at risk of being seen by the enemy, but I tread those paths without fear. He gives me the sure-footedness to navigate through the trials of this life with the feet of a deer. Because when God has done an etch-a-sketch on my plans, and when the anchors are cut, and when you're in the middle of the party or the middle of St. Helens, and inside you're broken, then just walking into your office in the morning can feel like treading the high places in full view of the enemy. Or at the end of a relationship or an bereavement, there can be an almost physical weakness, a brokenness. And in the face of pain, we can feel that our steps are faltering and uncertain. But when we know with certainty that it will not always be this way, when we know with certainty that though the night may be long, joy is coming. And when we know that it has been bought for us with the blood of the perfectly righteous Son of God, then it's not a raft, it's a rock. And we can get up in the morning and we can keep going. And so though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail and the fields yield no food, and there be no herd in the stall, let us rejoice in the Lord. Let us take joy in the God of our salvation. God the Lord is our strength. He makes our feet like the deer's. He makes us to tread on our high places. Now, sometimes we'll be able to say those words triumphantly, and sometimes we'll need to say them defiantly. And sometimes we will say them on our knees, broken and weeping. But my prayer is that we would be able to keep saying them until our certain salvation comes. We've got a bit of time now for questions and then to pray. The question is, wait a minute, I changed the question since here. What aspects of the new creation are most encouraging to you in the face of specific suffering here? Now, if it's too difficult to talk about things that are personal, I would encourage you, please do seek out people that you can talk to about these things. I hope there are people at St. Helens you can talk to. But around this table with people you may not know, feel free to talk about a situation that your friend is in, if that makes it easier, and how these truths would encourage them. And Satch, what time would you... Cool. Satch, you will close at 10 past, so we've got just over 10 minutes for that. So do make sure to take some time to pray.